So in June of 2011, the tornado that started in Springfield, Massachusetts, wiped out a part of Brimfield, Massachusetts. And we have a friend that lives in Brimfield, and his house literally was picked up and thrown in the woods. The only thing left standing on his house property was his children's bedroom closet. He has two boys, and they were both young at the time, and his wife had organized their closet so that their shirts were by color and by size in the closet. Very organized closet. The doors of the closet were ripped off and thrown in the woods, but not one shirt was touched. Literally, if you walked through the rubble of what remained of their house, they had a Roman tub in their master bathroom that was picked up and thrown in the woods. 20 feet to the left of where that tub was the closet with the doors ripped off and the boys' shirts on hangers organized by size and by color. So when I say his house was picked up and thrown in the woods, I mean everything except the boys' bedroom closet, for some reason, was picked up and thrown in the woods. The driveway is about 0.2 miles long, and they live on top of a hill, and it's very windy and twisty and steep. And the call came out that my friend's house had been picked up and thrown in the woods, and he needed help getting access to his house. Thankfully, no one was home at the time of the tornado. None of his family was hurt, and he has since been able to rebuild. And his house is beautiful, and everything worked out the way it was supposed to. But we got the phone call, hey, Pastor Josh, you know, your buddy needs help accessing his house to begin the recovery work. There were some chinchillas that they were concerned about running around somewhere, so they wanted to check on the chinchillas. There were some chickens that were running about. I don't think the chickens survived, but there were things he wanted to check. He needed access to his house. About 0.2 miles, maybe 0.3 miles driveway up a steep, curvy side of a hill. Why did they call me? Because he at the time, he lived on 5 acres of heavily forested, heavily wooded land. And every single one of the trees on his property, between 6 and 8 feet high, had been twisted and snapped and thrown. And so his driveway looked like a 3-year-old with a set of Lincoln Logs had a massive temper tantrum. That's what his driveway, just complete mishmash, a solid wall of mature oak timber mixed in with some pine, about 6 to 8 feet high, just completely impacted all the way up this driveway. It was Manville. It was Manville. And so I got the call because I have a chainsaw and I know how to run a chainsaw. And obviously the wood is a good thing too. And so me and two other buddies, we loaded up the truck. We had saws on board. We had fuel on board. We had chains on board. We had helmets on board. We had earplugs on board. We had safety glasses on board. We had some basic supplies on board, and when we were driving there, we couldn't go there the main route. The main routes were all down and impacted. There were power lines down across the road that we were driving over to get to the house. We pull up to the base of the driveway, and we're parked essentially in the middle of the road because it was the only thing that was clear, and we fired up the saws and just started handling business, just bury the bar kind of work. And by bury the bar, I mean that the chainsaw bar was 20 inches long, and you just stick the whole thing in the tree, and the bar is gone. And we're talking serious lumber, Manville. You need to know how to run a saw and how to run one well. And the challenge of this, it was the most challenging tree job I've ever been a part of, because normally when you put the bar into the log, the tree does one of two things. It either starts to open up a gap that allows you to continue the cut, or it goes the other way and tries to pinch the bar. If it tries to pinch the bar, there's a couple of different things that you can do, but you're trying to read the wood before you even engage the chainsaw so that you can anticipate what's going to happen. All of this wood was twisted in its core, and so you'd engage the wood with the chainsaw, and it would open and close, open and close, open and close, open and close, all the way through the wood. Never seen anything like it in my life. Incredibly challenging chainsawing, and if you've ever run a chainsaw with other guys or other people, you know that you kind of hope that you're all of a similar skill level because things can get very bad very quick. If you're cutting too close to each other, branches can start flying into other guys, the bar, the chains can kick back, and you can get in each other's way. And so it's nice if you're working with guys that are at the same level you're at. Well, one of my friends that came to respond to this had run a chainsaw a little bit, but he was not talented. He was not overly gifted with experience with how to run a chainsaw, and this was a very, very challenging situation, and it became very apparent to us that he just needed to be working somewhere by himself, because somebody was going to get hurt if he stayed too close to the rest of us who were trying to clear our way. And we all have moments like this where we come across an area where we're proficient, and we know what we're doing, and we're working with someone who just honestly isn't. And the temptation in this instance was to just go over and grab the chainsaw and say, "Here, let me." But the only problem with that is now no one's running my chainsaw. And so the answer isn't, "Here, let me," even though that's what you wanted to do, because, you know, I'm running my saw, and I'm kind of keeping my eye on him. He's a wonderful man of God, a great friend of mine. I'm kind of keeping my eye, and I'm like, "Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. Ah!" And then sure enough, disaster happens. And I felt like there's nothing, here, let me, you know. That's what I wanted to do. He's dulling the chain. He's pinching the bar. He's getting kickback. All this drama is happening. And as, you know, he learned a lot about how to run a saw during that event. But my temptation was to drop my saw, run over, grab his saw, and say, "Here, let me." But that obviously wasn't the answer. And we've all felt like this in any number. Maybe I've had the privilege of doing some painting in the past week. I kind of like painting. I kind of have a way that I like to paint. I was working with some people who said they knew how to paint, but they don't really know how to paint. And here, let me, you know, and I kind of had to back off and not jump in there. Or maybe, you know, you go to help a friend work on their car and you see what they're doing is just not going to work out well. And, you know, here, let me, this happens all the time with our kids. The temptation is, here, let me. And we have a hard time helping people move through these developmental phases that they need to go through to learn the kinds of things that they need to learn, because you care about them and you're afraid they're going to hurt themselves in the process, or they're going about something in a really terrible, bad way. And I always think of the Brimfield tornado and that extreme situation with my friend who just wasn't as experienced as I was with running a saw in a challenging set of circumstances. It's one thing when we run into these frustrating events when it's, you know, cutting wood, teaching a little one the proper way to load a dishwasher or run a washing machine, or teaching someone how to paint a wall, or working on your car. We all get how that can be frustrating when you're at a certain level of experience and you're trying to share that with someone who needs to come up a little bit. It's a totally different thing. It's a totally different thing when you've made some decisions of faith and you've seen God come alive in your life in different ways, and you've learned things in your marriage. You've learned things about parenting. You've learned things about being in church. You've learned things about giving of your time and your money to church. You've matured. You've grown to a certain level in Christianity. And it's one thing when it's loading the dishwasher and painting and some of these chores around the house. It's another when you have a loved one or a friend and they're making a train wreck of their marriage. And maybe it's something that you've been through, or maybe it's something that you've read about in the Bible, and you know what they need to do. Or at least you know the first couple of things that they need to do. You know that guy needs to be a lot more careful with his words. And it's very, very simple. He just needs to stop swearing at home, right? You know this because you know that the second that guy starts to cuss out his wife or cuss out his kids, there just gets to be this negative spiral, and people get fired up and angry and disrespected, and they feel unloved and things. And you know it's such a simple thing, and you can see it because maybe that was your thing. And then you had to kind of clean up your potty mouth, and the Lord convicted you in that area, and you stopped talking that way to your family, and you started using polite words. And then your marriage kind of, whoop, it went to a new level. And you can see it. It's one thing if it's a dishwasher, right? It's another when it's your friend's marriage, or your brother's marriage, or your sister's marriage. Or it's another thing when you see someone disciplining their kids, and they're like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 that little one needs some instruction right now." Or the opposite is true, like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, let's not jump on that little one. You know, he's just being..." Because maybe you've learned some things as you've matured in your faith about effective discipline. Do not, mothers and fathers, do not exasperate your children. Have clearly defined instructions about behavior regarding chores and how they're supposed to conduct themselves and how they're supposed to talk to mommy and daddy. And once you have those clearly defined structures, you have ways of reinforcing that positive behavior that all fall under biblical love. And then next thing you know, your kids are actually, you know, coming around a little bit. And then you go to a friend's house, and they're screaming at their children. They're just screaming. And it works for a while, but then the kids start to think it's funny. Now what do you do? And so there's just this drama in the house, and you know exactly what needs to happen. clearly defined expectations with rewarded behavior. You follow the biblical guideline, and you want to and you want to share it with them. You want to share it with them. Maybe you've experienced bankruptcy or some financial difficulty, and you've taken some biblical principles, and you've started to, you understand that debt is slavery. Debt is slavery. And so you've understood that as much as possible, let's not be slaves to anybody at any time in any regards. And so you started snowballing and paying down debt aggressively and buying used cars instead of new cars. And you've done different things to restructure your life financially so that you're a little bit ahead of the power curve instead of behind, because you've taken very close attention to what the Bible has to say. And then you have lunch with a friend, and he doesn't have the money to pay. And it gets real awkward real quick. And you're like, it's like $7, bro. And he doesn't have it. And you can see that your friend or your loved ones or your coworker are heading down a path. They're messing up in an important area in their life. They're immature in an important area of their life. And by God's grace, you have a little bit of biblical wisdom in this area, and you want to impart it. But you can't drop your chainsaw. You can't give them all your money. You can't start raising their kids. You can't be married to their spouse. You've got your own family. You've got your own children. You have your own relationships. You have your own financial responsibilities. What is a person of faith supposed to do in these areas of holy discontent? Holy discontent. You have a biblical perspective. Someone you know and love needs a little bit of that, but you can't drop your own. You can't disregard your own, but you want to impart a little to them. What does that look like? So Paul is on his missionary journey, and they've just left Berea, where they had a fantastic Bible study, and that was awesome. And we're in the book of Acts, chapter 17, and we're going to be looking, beginning in verse 16 in Acts chapter 17. Most of the scripture that I'm going to reference this morning is going to be on the screen. I'm going to move through it quickly in the interest of time, but I want to illustrate through the biblical text this principle behind how do we deal with holy discontent. We have a little bit of wisdom, we have a little bit of perspective, because God has moved powerfully in our lives, and we want to love those in a loving way around us. How do we share everything from the gospel to guidance about life? And so Paul has this experience, and we're going to read about it in Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 16. Now, Athens at the time was known as a center of great wisdom. It's still known historically as a center of great wisdom. In fact, the text is going to talk about that. And so let's jump into the text and read about Paul's experience with this idea in our minds that we're going to learn something about holy discontent. How do we share everything from the gospel to good information with people that we care about who just simply don't see things the way we do, at least not yet, when it comes to matters of faith, and they're making a mess. They're making a mess of their lives. Beginning in verse 16 of Acts chapter 17, "Now while Paul was waiting for them, his companions, at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols." He's angry. He's upset. These guys spend all their time, as the text is going to say, pursuing wisdom, and they had set up shrines all over the city to everything except God. And so they're trying to seek wisdom, they're trying to seek knowledge, and they're messing it up. They're doing a terrible job of it. They're going about it in all of the wrong ways. Paul is provoked, he's angry, he's upset. Verse 17, "So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers," Epicurean philosophy said, if it feels good, do it. Stoic philosophers said something different, and I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but it was something cool. "Also conversed with him, and some said, 'What does this babbler wish to say?'" The word babbler, if you look back into the original Greek language, it's referring to a bird that runs around and eats all the seeds that it can find. It doesn't matter what seeds it finds, it just eats all the seeds because the seeds are yummy. There's no filter. The bird does not apply any filter to the seeds that it finds. Or it can refer to a poor farmer who goes to market, and the cheap bags of seed for sale are the bags of seeds that are mixed. Could be corn, wheat, beans, who knows what, but the poor farmer just goes and buys the mixed bag of seeds and plants them, not discerning nor really caring what kind of crop comes up. He's just happy something's growing. They're saying, Paul, that's your philosophy. That's your teaching. it's a mixed bag of seeds. You're like a little bird that's just happy to find seeds, and you're eating these seeds indiscriminately. Epicurean philosophers and Stoic philosophers had a certain methodology to the way that they thought, and they thought Paul was just a random guy that picked up different strains of philosophy and threw them all together. Hey, babbler, what are you trying to say? Others said he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, the place of learning, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new, hence their reputation for pursuing wisdom that actually even persists to this day. Athens is known as the birthplace of modern sophistry or modern wisdom or even modern law. And so this is the introduction where we see that Paul has a holy discontent. He has godly wisdom, and he's in a city full of people who are seeking wisdom, and they're messing it up. They're going about it in ways that are not going to get them where they want to go. They're looking at a forest of trees, and they're chainsawing in the wrong place. They're not going to get to the house. They missed the driveway. They're trying to chainsaw straight up the side of the hill. They're trying to chainsaw into a neighbor's driveway. Hey, guys, the path to the house is here. And they're off cutting in the weeds somewhere. And so Paul hey, guys, if you're going to go through the time and effort of seeking wisdom, take the path that's going to get you where you want to go. And it has to do with Jesus Christ. So he gets his chance to preach to them. Now, there are a couple of things that Paul could have done that would not have worked in this situation. For instance, one of the things that Paul could have done in this situation is tell them that you're stupid. Hey, you guys think you're wise? You guys talk about wise stuff all the time? You guys even have cool names to your wisdom? You're idiots. You're dumb. You're stupid. That would not have been a productive start to the conversation. If in that same situation in Brimfield, if my friend was cutting up the side of the hill, me yelling over to him that he's an idiot is not going to convince him to come closer to me to cut up the driveway. Something else that Paul could have done, ignoring them would have been bad. I'm just going to let these yahoos do whatever they want. Well, it's not going to get them where they want to go. And so, you know, ignoring our friends that are, you know, screaming at their kids and think that's effective discipline, that's not the answer either. Because the kids at some point are just, you have to raise your level of voice. You just have to scream louder. Or maybe sometimes you have to do some other things to get their attention because now they're not paying attention to you at all. It doesn't matter how loud you scream. But so you can't ignore the situation, not as you love those kids. Another thing that Paul could have done that would have made no sense is he could have made demands. You guys come here right now and you come to this place and you listen to me real good. That wouldn't have been very attractive either because they thought they were wise. They didn't really even understand that they were cutting on the wrong side of the driveway. They thought they were actually wise. They had names for their little philosophies. And so, you know, telling them they were stupid, ignoring them, or making demands, none of those things would have been helpful. And you can easily think through the situations in your life where there's someone that's on your heart. As I've talked about friends and loved ones and coworkers that we know that are going through a tough time, somebody came to your brain, and maybe it's a situation with their kid, maybe it's a situation with their spouse, maybe it's a situation with their finances or some other unrelated area that I haven't talked about, but there's somebody that you thought of that you're like, man, if I could just have 30 minutes of their time and somehow impart this truth to them in a way where they would actually do something about it, I think it would change their life. Well, ignoring them would not get the trick done, right? It wouldn't do it. Yelling at them, calling them stupid is not going to do it. And making demands of them is not going to do it. And we know these things don't work because quite possibly we've tried. Hey, idiot, do you really think yelling at your kids is going to be an effective way? Do you really think cussing out your wife is going to draw her heart closer to your heart? Hey, do you really? Oh, this one's going to strike home. You ready? I might get in trouble for this one. Do you really think spending $20 on the lotto to maybe win $1 billion is the best use of your money? That one went home, didn't it? That one. You know, that guy had a halfway decent sermon right up until that point. Now I'm a little irritated at that turkey. That's not an effective way to draw people closer to you to hear the truth and the wisdom and the perspective, everything from the gospel to godly wisdom. There's a way to do it, but yelling at people, calling them stupid, or making demands is not the way. So what does Paul do? We're going to find out from the text, and we're going to move through the text very, very quickly. join me in Acts chapter 17 in verse 22, and let's take a look, because Paul does three things that are so wise that open up the door of opportunity, and then he does something else that we would never think that is a biblical course of action. But we're going to identify a couple of biblical principles here as we move our way through the text. So what does Paul do in this situation? Wholly discontent, he begins to preach to them, and he does three different things that we're going to identify very, very quickly, followed by a fourth. Verses 22 through 23, let's read them together. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." If you enjoy taking notes, I title these couple of verses, "Their Turf." He's talking to them on their turf. He's using places that are familiar to them. He's describing things in their life that are familiar to them. He thinks they're heading the wrong way. He's agitated. He's angry. He's provoked in his spirit. But look at the words that he uses. "I noticed this. I've observed this. You have this about you, that you are very, very religious, and you are earnestly seeking matters of faith and wisdom in every way. You're to be commended for your persistence, even though you're going the wrong way." Do you see how kind he is? On their turf, he identifies things that are very precious to them. It's what they know. It's who they are. It's where they live. And he says, "Good on you." Good. He's going to get there. This is not right. But he doesn't come in and say, "You're all known for wisdom. You're all idiots." He doesn't ignore them, and he doesn't make demands. He comes in, and he identifies with them where they live. He deals with their reality. "Hey, man, I've noticed your children are the most beautiful children. They are so cute. You and your spouse are kind of homely, but something happened magical with you guys because this little one is beautiful. Acts like a little devil, but looks like an angel. You have a great job. You do such a good job providing for your family. You're bringing in that paycheck regularly, and you get up early, and you stay up late, and I know things are a little rough. You're really trying to provide for your family. Dude, you married up. You married up. She is amazing. She could have had her choice of anybody, but she chose you." This is where these conversations start. This is where these conversations start. A holy discontent, we're going to get there, but it starts on their turf. Let's keep moving and see what Paul did with the wisdom that God gave him. Verses 24 through 27. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place so that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. And I labeled these verses the truth. He doesn't mince words. He just tells them the truth. There is a God. He created everything. And since he's the creator, he needs nothing. And that means your temples. Do you really think he needs pictures of himself made out of clay? Do you really think that the creator of the world who made volcanoes needs a bronze statue? Do you really think that's working for him? Do you really think you need to build a house out of marble for the guy that created marble in the first place? He doesn't need anything. He's God. He's amazing. And he's personal because he sent a man who at some day he's going to come and judge. He just drops it like it's hot. And so he starts on their turf, and then he shares the truth. Do you really think yelling at your spouse is effective? Do you really think after that man comes home from work and you start henpecking him about this, that, and every other thing, that is going to make him draw closer to you as a spouse and want to give you a hug and a kiss and hear about your day with the kids when he comes home? Do you really think that's going to work for you? Do you really think spending your money this way, that way, and every other way, instead of putting some aside for a rainy day, is going to be the best? What do you think is going to happen when it's time for college? What do you think is going to happen? You know, the tires on your car are wearing down. you're going to have to buy new tires. It's going to happen. It's not God's judgment on your life. It's just something you have to be prepared for. Do you really think blah, 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 blah is going to be effective? And so we handle the truth. We deal with the truth. We share the truth. I know that you've been seeking meaning in your life in all these different ways, but have you considered coming to church with me? I got something to tell you, man. God is present there. Have you really considered the fact that God is and that he loves you and he can prove it? And we share the truth, everything from the gospel to godly wisdom. This is what Paul does. So he starts on their turf, and then he shares the truth. And then finally, verses 28 through 31, he shares in their terms. Yet he is not actually far from each one of us, for, verse 28, he's quoting Greek poets. In him we live and move and have our being, and even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God has overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising from the dead. He starts using their terms. For us, it could be movie references. It could be Seinfeld references. It could be a story of the time when you struggled through the very same thing, when your words were not kind with your spouse, when your finances were a wreck, when your children were running around like little nutcases. But the bottom line is he started talking to them in terms by quoting from their own society, their own culture, their own poets, concepts that he was then able to effectively bring in godly wisdom. And so there's three principles here. If you're a note taker, this is a great Sunday for you. Number one, Paul spoke to them on their turf. Number two, he spoke to them about the truth. Number three, he spoke to them using terms that they could understand and use. And number four, if you go to verse chapter 18, verse 1, he dropped the mic. He left. And I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the text in front of me, but it says something like, and after these things, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. To the best of our knowledge, he didn't start a church there. He did these three things, and then the thing that we like to do the least, the fourth thing, he left them to their own devices. He let them make their own decisions. And I think it is so easy for us to forget that our brain controls our own legs. Our brain controls our own bodies. Our influence in our family is our own family. We don't get to fix anybody else. We don't get to tell people to make people walk a certain way or do certain things at all. All we can do is go to them on their turf, share the truth, and put it in terms that they can understand, and then we walk away and let them make their own decisions. And that's a hard thing, because sometimes as Christians, we really feel that the loving thing to do is to get all up in people's stuff and like try to drag them to church or berate them to church or to cajole them in some way. How did Jesus deal with this? Once upon a time, according to a parable that he taught in Luke chapter 13, a man planted a fig tree, and 3 years after it was supposed to be bearing fruit, he went to the fig tree, and there was no fruit on the tree. And so he went to the gardener and said, dude, what's up with the tree? Cut it down. And the gardener said, give me one more year, and I'm going to do the things that I can do to help this tree grow, and then if it doesn't produce fruit in a year, we're going to cut it down and give the space in the garden to something else. According to Mark chapter 4, once upon a time, a farmer planted seed in the ground, and after he'd prepared the ground and planted the seed, he went on his own way, and the seed brought forth, the earth brought forth the crop of its own accord. There's a clear biblical precedent, even through the parables of Jesus' teaching, that after we meet people on their turf and share the truth with them in terms that they can understand, disengage. We walk away, because that's actually a way of being kind to them. We can't make anyone else's decisions for them. Anything that we try to impress upon others and force upon others is only going to last as long as we have influence in their lives, and who knows how long that will be. But when a person makes their own decision of faith, that's God moving in their life, and the fruit from that will never fade or go away. So here's a concluding thought. We don't make choices for others, but for those that we love, we create an environment where good choices can be made. And this is just Josh talking here, right? There's no chapter and verse for this one, so don't try to look that one up. We don't make choices for others, but for those that we love, we create an environment where good choices can be made. Like I said, once upon a time, a guy planted a tree, and years went by, and it wasn't bearing the figs that it wanted. And so what did they do? They made sure that that tree had everything that tree needed, and then they established a timeline. If this tree has everything that it needs to bear fruit, and we come back this time next year, and there's no change in the life of this tree, we're probably just going to move on. We're going to separate ourselves from this tree. We're going to use our time in other ways. So Paul, in a very difficult circumstance, experiencing a certain degree of holy discontent through the wisdom and the grace and the blessing that God had given him, he knew the gospel, and he knew that he needed to preach the gospel in an environment where they had no interest in it whatsoever. So he met them on their turf, spoke to them the truth, and he put it in terms that they could understand. And then he walked away. And I hope that at the beginning of a new year, that this serves as a little bit of an encouragement to you, because maybe you have made some important decisions of faith over this past year. I know for a fact that for some of us, even just speaking for myself, being a part of River Church has been amazing. My faith has come alive in new ways in this past year and a half. And I think that's happening with others of us as well. And how do we share that with people who really need to be in River Church, who really need to be engaged in a life of faith, who really need to embrace the gospel, who really need to make other changes in their life? And I would humbly ask you this morning to take a page out of Scripture, Acts chapter 18, and think about and pray about those things that Paul did when he too experienced a high degree of holy discontent. And I hope it's an encouragement to you as you think about that this morning. And where it begins is by prayer. It begins with acknowledging where we are and asking God to do something amazing, because that's what we're asking for, is for God to reach out to people. How can we create an environment where these good decisions, everything from accepting the gospel to godly wisdom, can be received and acted on? And so we're going to have an opportunity to pray about that together this morning. And we're also going to have an opportunity to just give thanks to God for how he has provided for us. If you're here this morning and you realize this wisdom that I've been talking about, this godly perspective that I've been talking about, is not anything that you have, it comes through a relationship with Jesus Christ. And the truth of the matter is that we need a Savior. If we could forgive our own sins and heal ourselves of our own spiritual sicknesses and ailments and things that disgust us about ourselves, then we would have done it a long time ago. But instead, what we do is we like to cover that stuff up and hope that it goes away. Or we like to deal with it in other ways, and we're not seeing the progress. The answer is a spiritual answer, and it's repentance, of walking away from things that we know that are sin and embracing a life of faith in Jesus Christ for forgiveness. And then making some wise choices from there as his Spirit begins to move into your life. And so that might be something you want to pray about this morning as well. So join me as I pray, and then in a moment we'll stand and sing as we conclude our time together this morning. Heavenly Father, there are a group of people here this morning who we have ones that we love. There are people that we care about that are struggling in a certain way, and we know that if we could just hold their hand while they're painting, it wouldn't make a mess all over the place. That if we could guide them in this way or that way, that they too would experience the healing and power that we have experienced as you have moved through our lives through biblical precepts and concepts that we've been obedient to, whether it be receiving the gospel or godly wisdom. Father, I pray that you would give us the humble ability to love people where they're at, to help create an environment where they can hear in their terms, in their turf, the truth about you, and that you would give us the grace and the confidence when it's appropriate to walk away and let your word be amazing and powerful in the lives of those that we know and love. We ask these things in Jesus' name.